Welcome to episode 9 of Taekwondo, The Shame Chronicles. I'm Kyle.
And I'm Melanie.
And I'm special guest Josh.
And this is the show where everything's made up and the points don't matter. That's not true. I think Drew Carey is probably going to sue us now. I take that back. This is the show where we talk about sort of the embarrassing things that we did growing up and still continue to do as adults, and also about anything else that we decide to talk about. So just for those of you who haven't listened to the first 8 episodes, if you're a new listener, that's what this is about. It's sort of the show about anything. Guys, I wanted to start off this episode by bringing back a fan favorite, or at least I'm assuming it's a fan favorite, because nobody has called in to tell us that they hate it yet. And that is the Kyle apologizes for something that he did segment. I think this has probably been building for the last couple of episodes, and that is, I just want to apologize to all of our foreign listeners for my blatant ethnocentrism and xenophobia. Specifically, I think in the last episode, I'm really afraid that we turned off a lot of our foreign listeners, particularly our listeners in England, who I believe I called limey bastards. I made fun of them for their mispronunciation of words. So England, I apologize to you and all of your people, but you still mispronounce words. I mean, being honest here, your pronunciation of certain words is pretty horrendous. But I apologize for calling you out on it, and I'll apologize next time for calling you out on it this time. I also want to apologize to Australia for calling them mini limey bastards. And, I mean, it's probably unfair. Well, as far as I know, Australians hate it when you confuse them with Britons, Englishmen. So I just want to apologize for making that comparison, and also for saying that basically, well, for everything that I know about your language coming from the Outback Steakhouse. So I apologize to England, I apologize to Australia. Finally, I want to apologize to Germany, because I think I said that your language is a monster language.
Yeah, that sounds right.
We were doing like a little skit, right? So, I mean, I was just in character of somebody who was sort of xenophobic. So, Germany, I'm sorry I called your language a monster language. Your language is a little bit scary. I don't think there's any denying that, but it's not a monster language. And I'm also pretty sure that your word for aluminum is not hell. So I apologize for that, too. I feel like I have to do this because I think about 5% of our listeners are from other countries. So I really, really don't want to turn off any listeners at this point. Maybe when we get up to like 100,000 or something, then I can piss off an entire country or an entire continent. And maybe it won't matter as much. But for now, I apologize to everyone. I guess I also apologize to Americans who were insulted by my ethnocentrist remarks as well. Okay, so now that we have the apology segment out of the way,
well, can I go ahead and apologize to all those countries as well for my accents?
Sure,
and also Russia.
Oh yeah, for not having one ready to go.
Yeah. I think that's a pretty big oversight.
Yeah, well, a little bit later on in this episode, I think we're probably also going to be apologizing to Austria, but we'll get to that later. That's a little bit of foreshadowing for you. All right, guys, I want to talk about something that's sort of the theme of the show, and that's the fear of embarrassment, like with whatever it is that you're doing at the time, like not being sure if what it is embarrassing or stupid or whatever. Over the weekend, I thought of two situations in my life where this sort of feeling was reinforced and maybe multiplied and expanded in my mind to sort of make me the person who I am today. One of these was in fourth grade. We had, as part of one of the classes, part of the, reading class or whatever, we had to sort of, the whole class would read a book together, and the teacher would sort of go around the room and pick people at random, or maybe not so random in some cases, and ask everyone to sort of read, a couple of paragraphs before moving on to the next student. So the problem with this is that I had an idea of how these words, you know, were supposed to be pronounced in my head, but I hadn't ever heard them pronounced by someone out loud. So these are words like ptarmigan, that has a silent P, oscillation, which has a silent C, just, you know, words like that. I remember sort of an earlier experience, in like maybe second grade when I got this book called, The Fox in the Socks by Dr. Seuss. The main character's name was, Knox, K-N-O-X, like the fort. So I think this maybe set me up for the fourth grade scenario, which I'll get to in a second. But I think our parents first read this to us, Melanie. And when they were reading it, they pronounced it, you know, Mr. Knox or whatever his name was.
Right.
And I hadn't paid attention to the book. I had just looked at the pictures or whatever, but not the words when they were reading it to me. And then so when I was reading it later on my own, I saw the K there and was like, well, were my parents pronouncing this wrong? Because at the time I didn't know that the KN letters together was just the N sound with the K was silent.
Right.
I guess I sort of realized about halfway through the book, you know, that this was the case, that my parents probably were not pronouncing this wrong, but that some words are not pronounced anything like what they look like. So going back to this fourth grade reading thing, I specifically remember a scenario. I think we were reading a book called, To Build a Fire, something like that. And the word was ptarmigan, as I mentioned. And the kid who was going, right before me pronounced it as ptarmigan. I'm thinking, well, that doesn't sound like that could be a real word. I was pronouncing it ptarmigan in my head. But when he said it, the teacher didn't stop him to correct him. And so I was like, oh, holy crap. I was like, if I was reading that part, I would have said it wrong. I would have said ptarmigan. And then this kind of happened a little bit more. The teacher never really ever stopped someone to pronounce words correctly. I think, I'm guessing the whole purpose of this, this assignment or this exercise was just to get kids comfortable with reading.
Right.
I guess it would probably be sort of a hit to their confidence if, every other word that they pronounced was wrong and the teacher had to stop them. So I understand why the teachers did this, but for me, this was one of those things where, we took these, reading tests or whatever, and I was, always way ahead of the rest of the class because I didn't have, many friends and I really liked to read. So, I was reading it. According to these tests, I was reading at a 14th grade reading level in fourth grade. And so I was pretty confident that I was pronouncing all these words right in my head. And then this happened, and I was like, oh, well, maybe I've been pronouncing these words wrong, you know, this whole time. And then I had this, constant fear whenever I was reading after that, especially, in public or in front of people, that I was pronouncing these words wrong. Right. So that's one experience. The second experience happened. Well, actually, before we move on to the second experience, you guys are both teachers.
Yeah.
Obviously, you teach at a higher level than fourth grade. But what would you guys have done in this situation? Would you have let the kids continue on with the mispronounced word, or would you have stopped them?
Well, so this does happen even in our classes and with words that are not necessarily like, you know, like the vocabulary isn't necessarily very difficult all the time. And I'm definitely the kind of teacher that like, I don't want to embarrass my students, and I know some of them don't read as much as others. And so I probably would fall in the camp that your teacher fell into, but I also, as a student, fall into the camp that you fall into. So it's kind of a bit of a contradiction. But I usually only jump in if the student pauses and they seem uncertain.
Sure.
Or if another student later reads the same word and they're like, and they clearly seem to be trying to negotiate what the right pronunciation is, then I'll jump in and tell them. But, so,
sorry, yeah. Based on what you just said, maybe there's like a third sort of situation that I'd never really thought about, and that is sort of a lesson for life. Whereas if you don't know something, as long as you're confident about it, no one's going to stop you.
Yeah, like 4 times the square root of 8 is 162.
Yeah, most people are. I mean, if you're like, if you just like, you could pretend to be Dustin Hoffman's character in whatever that movie was, Rain Man.
Rain Man.
Yeah.
Hey, at least I remember the actor's name this time. Yeah. You could just. I mean, you could pretend like if somebody dropped like. You know, a big thing of pens or whatever, you could just yell out a number that looks sort of appropriate. And then they're going to think that you've got this like crazy, beautiful mind. And maybe you're haunted by people who aren't actually there, but that's kind of a cool superpower that you have. But I feel like, if you're not confident about it and you're wrong, that's sort of like a two hit combo against you.
Right.
That's true.
But I really feel like the teacher not correcting the one student is sort of hurting everybody else. It's yeah. Like it's like do you hurt one student's confidence you know, but then teach everyone else something wrong?
Right.
Or do you keep that one kid's confidence up? I mean, I guess, I don't know, what's more important to you guys as teachers? Do you want, I mean, I guess making a kid sort of interested in learning and keeping up that confidence to push forward is probably the most important thing. But at a certain point, is there some sort of like equation that goes through your mind? Like, I'm teaching a class of 30 kids. Do I want 29 kids to be taught something wrong? Or like maybe if it was like a, like some sort of internet class where it was like 1,000 students or something, like at that point, would it make sense to correct the guy?
I think it depends on what the word is or what the situation is. I mean, if it's important that they understand the vocabulary, then yeah, I think you should correct them. But if it's just like this happened in one of our fiction workshops one time where we had to go around the room reading a story together. And, it was like a place or something that had a weird name. It wasn't Montauk, but I'll just say Montauk because that's the first thing that came to my head. But like, people would like I knew it was Montauk, but then like 7 people in a row said something like Montauk. And I was like, well, because then you start feeling like you're this like smug, superior person if you didn't pronounce it correctly after 7 other people have said it wrong. But then it's also like, then if you fall into the same trap, then the 8th person or the 9th person or whatever, then they say it right, then you're like, well, I knew it was right, I just didn't want to embarrass all those other people. So like, it happens. I mean, but in that particular instance, like, it doesn't really matter how you, I mean, I guess some people would say that it matters, but it doesn't change your comprehension or whatever. So
I lean on the side of just being right and having my students know what is right. And I think this is probably part of why I don't have any idea how to teach kids how to read, so I wouldn't be good at that. But in college, I think if you're not saying, you know, if they mispronounce a word and then you can correct them and make it sound like they're stupid, you know, like, it's not ptarmigan, jeez, you know. Or you could just say, it's ptarmigan, and then I don't feel like they should be that embarrassed. It's just like, it's something you didn't know, so.
Right. Yeah.
But it's also one of those things where, like, I'll occasionally have my students read, you know, each of them read a paragraph just to get through, like, a short article or something. And it's one of those things where you always read silently faster than anybody else is going to read aloud. So you feel this, like pressure to, like, speed things along for some reason. And so if people, like, get hung up or they hesitate a lot when they're reading, like, sometimes I just feel like, oh, I'll just, you know, let them keep going because it's going to take even more time for me to, like, jump in and correct them. And I don't know.
Yeah, and then once their confidence is shaken, they're probably going to, like, be even more self-conscious and slow down even further, right?
Yeah.
Like, I have that problem.
Yeah. Okay.
I have that problem when I'm reading. I'm, like, way more concerned about not making an ass of myself or, like, not saying something wrong. That right. But when I'm done, I don't remember anything that I read.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm the same way. I mean, it's a really... It's, for some reason, it's a high-pressure situation, even, like, when you're in your 20s.
It is. It's like... Yeah, I don't know what it is. It's just that pressure of not looking stupid in front of your peers or in front of even like your superiors, your teachers or bosses or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Or even in front of people who are your I don't want to say lessers.
Your inferiors.
The people who are lower in status in whatever position you're in.
Right.
Like you especially don't want to make an ass of yourself in front of those people. So
yeah,
or even people who whose opinions you care nothing about. It's, you know, it's like I don't actually care what they think of my reading, but I do have to do the best possible thing I can. I had this experience once reading in a college classroom, and it was a pretty long passage. I was reading for a while, and then I started thinking about my reading voice and how it sounded a little weird. And I read for like 5 or 6 minutes, and most of the time I was thinking about myself speaking, and then I realized that in the middle of it, and I was like, oh, what if I stop reading because I'm not even thinking about what I'm reading? But my mouth was just going the whole time I'm reading. I assume it was correct because no one ever stopped me.
It can be like sort of an out of body experience though. Like if you become aware of yourself reading and it's a long enough period of time that you're reading for, I get this weird thing. It's like tunnel vision where I can only see the very next word. And it's like, I start panicking like, oh my gosh, what if like, what if in 5 words, I don't know the next word that's there or like, or again, like just an unfamiliar word and it takes you half a beat longer to like think about how to pronounce it or whatever.
Yeah.
So, okay. Now that I know that this is sort of a common human experience and not just something specific to me in fourth grade and currently and for my entire life.
Well, just because Melanie and I agree with you doesn't necessarily mean it's common.
Sure.
We probably all fall into a similar subsection of students.
Sure. But it does seem common enough, right?
Yeah.
And I'm sure that you guys as teachers probably see this in a lot of your students as well.
Mm-hmm.
But because of this, I'm just curious, like, what's the point of making people read in front of other people then? Is it just for the teacher's sake so that they know that you know how to read?
Well, when I do it, it's because I want us to engage with a text in class, but I don't want to have to read the whole thing.
Well, okay. I guess that makes sense. So you're sort of taking the burden off of yourself and putting it on the rest of your class.
Yeah, and also they get sick of listening to me anyway, so it's not even just for myself. It's just like, if they know that they're going to have to read in a few paragraphs, they're more likely to keep paying attention.
You know what would be the most terrifying thing to me? That's if a teacher asked me to read something, and then immediately following what I read, asked me what it was about. Ask me to interpret it in some way.
Yeah, I mean, you do run the risk of students just, like, counting ahead how many paragraphs before they have to read, and then reading that paragraph silently while everybody else is reading, and then...
Oh, I totally did that.
Yeah, I do it too sometimes.
So, this was another problem I had in fourth grade, and that is, like, so we moved around a lot because of our parents' jobs and when they got divorced and stuff like that. So, we moved around between cities and between sort of school districts, between states, how, you know, each state kind of does it in a slightly different way. And there was a point, I'm assuming, where they taught you what a paragraph was. And whatever point this was after the point where we left, like, Kansas, but before the point where we got to Colorado. So the teacher would, like, ask the class to read, like, a paragraph, and as soon as you're done with the paragraph, the next student would read or whatever. And I was just terrified, but, like, I probably should have just asked what a paragraph was, since I was the new kid, and I'm sure the teacher would have, like, understood that this wasn't just, like, some, like, dumb student. but I didn't ask, because I was terrified, that everyone else would think I was stupid. And so, luckily, I could kind of figure it out based on where everybody else would, like, start reading and stop reading, that it was, hey, the little indentation in the line of, or in the lines of text. I think that that's, I don't know, that fear of, like, asking for help is also kind of a problem, so.
Yeah. I agree.
I think for me, as a teacher, and I don't have any pedagogy to back this up, but I do think it's good to have some sort of practice reading out loud and, you know, you just kind of deal with things that are uncomfortable in general. So I know most of my students don't necessarily enjoy it, but it's like, well, it's not going to hurt you. I mean, I guess it could. It could hurt them, but... I don't know. I think if you are creating an environment that doesn't feel like people are judging necessarily, that kind of helps.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's move on to the second scenario that I thought of, because I think this one's a little more poignant. And that is, when I was a junior or senior in high school, my computer science teacher recommended me for this thing called Next Tech Future Leaders of Technology or something like that. And it was like a little week long field trip thing to Austin where you would basically go there and you would sort of be there amongst like 200 or 300 of your peers who were all sort of into technology or computers or whatever. And then part of it was like going around to various technology places in Austin, to see like how like businesses were run in the field of technology. And one of these field trips was to a game company. I think they were called Digital Anvil. I don't remember what game they made. I think it was like Free Space or something. Which was like a space, exploration game. And part of the tour of their company was they sort of showed us how they recorded the audio for certain things, like how they recorded voices. Mm-hmm. And so sort of in the middle of this tour, they asked for a volunteer to lend their voice to like basically read a line, from a script. And then they would show us how they sort of like modified all the audio to make it sound like an alien. And so the question to the group of people was, who wants to come up here and read this thing like an alien? And so like half of the people in the group raised their hands, me included. Fortunately, I wasn't picked, which which we'll come to in a second. But basically, the line was something like, the line that the person had to read was something like, what do we do with the human? And the instructions were, read this in your best alien voice. And the person who read it just sort of read it like sort of like a sort of almost monotone, like really clear, almost like radio voice. Maybe not necessarily monotone, but just like lacking a lot of emotion. Right. And it was, and he read it something like this: "What do we do with the human?" Which in my mind was nothing like how an alien would talk, right? But I hadn't heard the aliens in this game before, so I didn't know exactly what they were looking for. And as soon as he said it, I was like, oh, thank God that was him and not me. Because in my mind, I was going to pronounce the line something like this: "What do we do with the human?" And so, like, as soon as he said that, I was like, oh, thank God that wasn't me. And basically, you know, that same sort of fear of, like, embarrassing myself just immediately got, like, 10 times stronger. Like, there was no more volunteering for things after that.
The sad part is they probably would have then decided, you know, we should hire this guy to start doing these voices.
Yeah, like thinking back on it now, the guy that actually volunteered who got picked probably didn't do it right. But they didn't make fun of him or anything. They weren't like, no, say it more like an alien would, not like a professor. Or maybe not a professor, but whatever. But yeah, it was just one of those things where it was like, you know, sort of end of puberty, like middle of high school, like sort of insecurity just being reinforced because I didn't do something like one of my peers did. So
school is really great at getting people to conform to things. That's what it's all about.
I know, it like completely tamps out any creativity. Like, you had a completely creative way of saying that line, then because somebody else didn't say it very creatively at all, it was like, oh, I must be wrong.
And other people have really creative ways of pronouncing words.
Like Ptarmigan.
Yeah. That sort of reminds me of another experience I had in high school. This is like when we first moved to San Diego. It was the beginning of my junior year, and they asked us in, I think, my English class, our teacher, Mr. Richards, I think. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Mr. Richard.
He sort of asked everyone sort of in a line to get up and say, you know, who they are and give a little bit about themselves. And I swear to God, like 10 people who were all sort of friends, you could tell because of the way they were dressed, that they all hung out together. Each one of them got up and said the exact same thing, and it was this: "Hi, my name's so-and-so. I like to think of myself as a nonconformist. I don't really like, I don't really try to dress and act like the way society wants me to." And yeah, it was literally like 10 people, like 5 people in a row too, because they were all, they were all friends and were like sitting together.
Right. Yeah, it's always fun to see, to what lengths people will go to be different, and then all end up being the same, basically.
Yeah. Kyle, do you remember, like, our first day of school in San Diego? I don't know what you were wearing, but I distinctly remember what I was wearing because it was quite different from what everybody else was wearing.
So do you want to talk about school fashion?
Well,
or particularly what we thought was fashionable?
Well, okay, so we came from College Station, Texas, which, especially when you're not in college yet, is a pretty, like, fairly conservative, sort of wholesome kind of place to grow up. And, like, people dressed like they were from a Gap commercial, for the most part. Or at least my friends did. And sure. When we moved to San Diego, I remember exactly what I was wearing. I was wearing khaki pants from the Gap with brown Doc Marten boots and a 3/4-length white shirt on the first day of school. And when I got to school, what other people were wearing was like mini skirts that when they sat, I'm pretty sure their underwear touched the seat. And those backless shirts that like had just like ties or whatever to hold them on. And our lunch was outside. And so girls would be like trying to sunbathe during lunch. And I went home and pretty much was like, I go to school with a bunch of prostitutes. And I felt really stupid in what I was wearing.
Yeah, I mean, San Diego was kind of a culture shock for a lot of reasons, fashion being one of them, sort of the general culture of the school being another one. Like I was a little bit surprised by the amount of drugs that happened.
Right.
Which, I mean, I guess that happened in College Station, too. I just was never around it. I guess I wasn't really around it a whole lot in San Diego, either, but you heard of it a lot more. But then also, just like weird things, like in Texas, like football and cheerleading are like the two things that make you popular.
Right.
Whereas in San Diego, it was like the water polo team and like, I don't know what it was for girls. Maybe still the water polo team. I'm not sure.
No, I can tell you from experience. No. But yeah, it was weird things, or like being on the surf team or something. Like, well, maybe not being on the team, but being a surfer. Sort of.
Definitely being a surfer made you cool. Yeah, I don't know. Did we actually have a surf team? Was that a thing?
We did.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah, so yeah, fashion was something that I didn't really get all throughout high school anyway. So for me, like, I was just sort of oblivious. I guess it was cool because all the girls were dressing a lot sluttier when we moved to San Diego. So that was fine. But as far as, like, the clothes that I would wear, it didn't really make a difference to me one way or the other. Partly because I think, like, fashion was a lot sort of more laid back in San Diego. Like, in Texas, it's all, like blue jeans and t-shirts, or if you're, like, one of the not cool kids, it was like Jankos and t-shirts. T-shirts were kind of common to everyone.
Josh, you grew up in Texas too. What did you wear in high school?
Well, when I was in high school, I dressed like I was in a grunge band. So
I wore a lot of flannel. That's because you're significantly older than I am.
Yeah. Yeah, Kurt Cobain had just recently died.
Torn blue jeans, or
A lot of blue jeans, loose, baggy.
But a lot of flannel.
You had longer hair too.
Do what?
You had longer hair too, right?
Yeah.
Like, how long are we talking? Like, did you have a ponytail, or just like shaggy?
No, just chin length, probably. Maybe a little bit longer at some point, but I got to a point where I could put my hair in a very small ponytail, but that was not generally a good idea.
Sure.
It looked pretty stupid.
It's good that you had the self-consciousness, I guess, to see that.
Yeah. I mean, there were pretty clear divisions between, like, people wearing sort of cowboy clothes and then people who were, it was like, I guess the divisions were, like, kicker.
Yeah.
Right.
And, it's like cowboy boots and blue jeans and,
yeah.
And, like, button-down shirts, right?
It's true that everybody had blue jeans.
But these were, like, tight blue jeans.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they're usually darker.
Shirt tucked in, usually.
Yeah.
Yeah. They're dark, a darker blue versus, like, a more washed.
Yeah, like giant belt buckle.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and cowboy hat, or you could have, like, a baseball, you know, a worn baseball cap. That was acceptable.
Sure.
And then preps, who then had some sort of polo-type shirt.
Who dressed like a Gap commercial.
Yeah, what Melanie was talking about.
But I wasn't a prep.
You would have been at my school.
Personality-wise, you weren't, Melanie, but the fact that you cared about fashion at all, and it wasn't all just like like blue jeans and like a top or whatever, you sort of, you dressed preppy, but your personality wasn't preppy, so.
All right, I can handle that.
Well, I felt the same way, like, later when I was in, I think in grad school, probably, or later in college, I was working with high school kids, and one of them called me a prep one time. I was like, what? What are you talking about? And then I was like, oh, yeah, I do have, like, a some sort of alligator on my polo shirt here. Because, you know, I had to go to a job and stuff. That's the kind of thing you do.
Yeah, Melanie, I would say, like, just to reinforce that a little bit, if you were ever in high school and you ever owned a pair of capri pants...
I owned, like, one.
All it takes is one pair.
And they were really cute.
No, but, like, I remember, Melanie, basically everyone on the swim team, like, because I was on the swim team a year ahead of you, so they all sort of knew me. But then when you joined, like, I remember everyone just talking about how, like, fashionable you were and how cool you were for, like, the clothes you were wearing.
That's so strange.
Which, those sort of, like, compliments that I heard about you sort of drove me the other way. Not that I would have... not that I would have really changed my outlook on fashion a whole lot regardless, but made me want to try a whole lot less. Because I was never going to be, like, on the same level as you. But...
That's so weird for me.
So this was what I wore pretty much throughout my entire high school career, and that was like a combination of sweatpants. I'm talking about pants first. I would either wear sweatpants, like windbreaker pants. Sometimes like a jean short.
A jort.
Yeah. Like a pair of like khaki slacks. Basically anything that was loose.
Right.
That was comfortable to sit in or run in or whatever. Like if I needed to be physically active at a moment's notice, I could do it. And then as far as like shirts went, I pretty much exclusively wore like giant baggy swim meet themed t-shirts.
Yeah.
Like shirts that were like extra large on my like 6'2" like 145 pound frame.
Yeah, but I mean when you're swimming as much as you were, it becomes kind of annoying to like make a production about what you're wearing when you're not swimming.
Is that true?
Well,
I mean, I can see that for like a girl because like girls are expected to wear like makeup and like do their hair and everything. Like I didn't even have to worry about those things. All I had to worry about was the things that I clothed myself with. like in one context, I'm wearing like a tiny ass Speedo, and in another context, I'm wearing like the hugest clothes that I could possibly find.
Maybe you're just overcompensating for how naked you were the rest of the time.
Maybe.
Well, okay, so I would say, like, probably the pinnacle of me caring about what I looked like was, like, 8th and 9th grade. And then when we moved to San Diego and I realized that I was not going to dress like a prostitute and therefore would not fit in with everybody, I pretty much started wearing more of the, like, wind pants, and I wore pajama pants to school. Like, every other day of my senior year. So I pretty quickly, like, stopped wearing makeup and just had my hair in a ponytail pretty much all the time. So. So that, I guess.
Yeah. I think maybe my aversion to jeans started at a young age when Dad would, like, take me clothes shopping, and he would buy me jeans. This was at third grade, maybe, that uh-huh. I have memories of this. And he'd take me to, like, Walmart or wherever, to the jeans section, and I'd end up with, like, this pair of jeans that was, like, maybe an inch or two too short, and, like... like uncomfortably tight around my legs, and I think that gave me sort of the wrong impression of jeans that I just carried through with me all the way until my freshman year in college, when I rediscovered jeans and started wearing them.
Yeah.
In junior high, I went through a year where I wore shorts every single day. Even when it was like in the winter when it got pretty cold, I was purposely like, no, I don't care, I'm doing this. I've gone 5 months wearing shorts and I'm gonna keep going.
I remember a similar phase. I think it was in junior high. I did a lot of like organized sports in junior high because the town we lived in, basically, for every season, there was a sport that you could do that was organized by the city. And by the mm-hmm. time I got into junior high, pretty much everyone who was in any way remotely athletic at all did all the sports. So I did football, I did wrestling, I did basketball, but I didn't do basketball in junior high, but, part of the deal of doing the sports is that you got sort of the athletic clothing, the branded athletic clothing for the school, which was like a t-shirt and like a pair of mesh shorts that said West Junior High on it, or West Middle School. And this was like the most comfortable thing you could possibly ever wear. And so I made it a point to wear this at any time that it was appropriate. Or that I thought it was appropriate, which was basically any time except while I was physically in class or at church. So I had like a similar thing where I had like a big like starter jacket because it was freezing outside in Kansas, and then I would wear my mesh athletic shorts, sort of pulled down a little bit below my butt because my starter jacket went down that low. And the lower I pulled my shorts, the more leg they covered. Because it was freezing, but I didn't want to wear pants, so... so yeah, that was... This segment has just been full of embarrassing things.
I should say, before we close it, that I'm actually wearing a pair of those mesh shorts right now.
Yeah, earlier Josh was like, have you seen my black athletic shorts?
They're and I actually stole them from my brother. They are from when he played high school football. So.
I'm pretty sure that I stole either Kyle, your shorts, or Andrew's shorts at some time.
Yeah,
and I think was wearing those for a while as well.
Yeah, I think I vaguely remember that. They were like, these aren't like traditional or like the modern day basketball shorts that like go down below the knee. These are like three quarters of the way down the thigh is where they stopped. So it wasn't even like knee level.
Right.
And of course, you know, at that time all the cool kids were like sagging and stuff anyway. So they were doing what I did with when I had my starter jacket on, but just like all the time. Where it was
you
like
you were doing it to be cool and you were doing it to be warm.
Okay. That's probably enough about fashion and our embarrassment meter. You guys have been listening to Taekwondo at the Shame Chronicles. We'll be right back.